the Batmobile. Let's go.
To SER's Arts and Culture Show.
Don't make me say it's so hot right now.
Tan caliente ahora!
Your weekly dose of arts and culture.
And all of that sort of stuff.
It's that weird thing that they're classics because they're classics because they're classics, and then they become the classics and everyone wants to do the classics because they're classics.
He's amazing.
Well, you need a lot of room for all that blood.
And he's hot as a firecracker.
You're listening to So Hot Right Now. You better not use me saying that.
Amazing babes.
On 2SER 107.3.
Hello, hello, hello. You're listening to So Hot Right Now, your weekly dose of arts and culture here on 2SER. My name is Sophie, taking you through till midday as we chat all things at the moment, performing arts for this long weekend edition. Hope you're having a fantastic long weekend. Oh, doesn't it feel good to have a break? Not for me, but for all of you, yay. But on today's show, we've got a big one for you. We're going to be chatting with Craig Baldwin, the director of a new play that's coming out at the Seymour Centre this week. It's called The Flick. Now, this is a Pulitzer Award-winning play by Annie Baker, and we're going to be chatting to him all about it. Also, Christina Chan, she's an award-winning choreographer, and she's got a new piece coming out called Mountain, and it's premiering at the Campbelltown Arts Centre. And we're going to be chatting to her about that. And, oh my gosh, I just realised I have three award winners on this show today. We're also going to be talking to playwright Michelle Lee, who won the Premier's Award in Drama. She's got her first full-length play going down, has just premiered at the Sydney Theatre Company. So we're going to be catching up with her all about that. We're still going to have heaps of music. I'm going to steer a bit to the bluesy side because, hey, it is Blues Fest weekend. So we're going to kick some things off with a bit of Mojo Juju with Sugar Coated. You're into SER.
Just another ad campaign. It's the same, it's the same. In the end, this ain't no cakewalk. Oh no, and they are not your friends. And you can keep on trying to tell yourself that things are gonna change, but it's the same again. We'll be right back.
The Cassiola Powerhouse Arts Centre is a world-class venue in southwest Sydney with a busy schedule of exhibitions, theatre, film and workshops. Join us in March for the Archibald Prize, Shakespeare's Hamlet, Italian film screenings and more. Set along 2 kilometres of riverfront, the Arts Centre features 2 theatres, 6 galleries and a fantastic restaurant with a Cordon Bleu chef creating an ever-evolving menu inspired by locally grown produce. There really is something for everyone, and best of all, entry is always free. Cassiola Powerhouse sponsors 2SER.
That was Chris Agilo and his Cubanos with Afro Mood. On top of that, you also heard from Mojo Juju, a bit of a local flavour with Sugar Coated. You're here on So Hot right now with me, Sophie.
Stories, ideas, music. 2SER 107.3.
There's no doubt about it. We live in a world where human activity is critically affecting the environment. Exploring this concept through dance, Sydney-based choreographer Christina Chan is looking at this relationship between humans and nature in a trilogy of works. She'll be unveiling part 2 of the series, Mountain, at Campbelltown Arts Centre from April 13 to 14, and she joins us on the line now. Hello, Christina.
Hi.
Thanks so much for having me. Not a problem. So what kind of drew you to the subject of climate change as a theme for this series of works?
Well, I guess it was a gradual progression. When I first became interested in making my own work, because I've been a dancer and performer in many works over the last almost 19 years now. So once I began to make my own work, I was really questioning what it is that's of interest to me, and there were all these connections coming up with my personal interest with the environment and wanting to connect to nature, but then also choreographically, how do I work in the space, particularly alone, because that's how I began choreographing, just myself in an empty studio, sort of working with myself in the space. And so all these connections started to come up with how did I want to move, and what moved me, and why would I move? All these questions have been, you know, sort of bubbling in the back of my mind for many years, and everything that sort of came up that was of interest was environmental in some way. Like, for instance, how can I be moved by wind? Or I guess it was like I was trying to find some kind of dancing impetus, or like almost like a partner to dance with. And I started exploring these external landscapes, but then also internal landscapes, and that gave me inspiration to move my body and break out of the restrictions that dancing for so many years has sort of were sort of blocking me. But then also connecting to my interests. So, like, it really all kind of just aligned and made sense after, you know, quite a few attempts, maybe a couple of years of grappling with what is it that I want to make? Like, what's this bubbling inside of me?
Yeah. So you debuted part one of Faint Existence at Liveworks. How did that, what kind of aspect of the environment and climate change did you explore in that one?
Yeah, that was so that was my first major work that I made with an amazing team of collaborators. So I think through the process of making that work, I realised that climate change is a very difficult subject to dance.
It's quite complicated.
But how do... Yeah, there are a lot of questions. How do I... What am I dancing about? What is this? How do I translate these ideas through my body and then to an audience? And it became very apparent that actually the work isn't necessarily about climate change, but it's like a personal response, or thinking about, particularly in that work, because it was a solo work, how does the individual contribute to the world, or how do we relate to our environment, and how are we impacted by it, and how do we impact? So it was a very, you know, personal response to what is happening in that climate change idea, like, of concepts, and is it, you know, I'm quite a strong believer in that it is happening, but, you know, there's many questions around that. And then it really came back to these personal, really internal landscapes as well. It's like, how do we individually cope with change? And, like, there's a real connection for me in these works about internally and who we are and our personal experiences, and then the outside world as well, and how they're reflected between the two.
Yeah. So with part two, Mountain, which is coming up in a couple of weeks' time, how does this kind of differ? Like, what direction are you taking from A Faint Existence into Mountain?
Yeah, well, I guess firstly I'm working with most of the collaborators are the same collaborators that we work together on A Faint Existence. So already there's a connection between the two works, and that's actually when the idea of this trilogy came to play. We were discussing how actually it's a continuation of our the practice we're developing and the language that we're developing together, and actually you can't express all of these things that we were trying to investigate in one work. It seemed, you know, impossible, and all these other things were coming up. So then once we started making Mountain, things have already evolved in how we're thinking about these ideas of environmental change and how we relate to our environment. And so with Mountain, the main focus is really on these concepts of invisible or lost landscape. So it's like this idea of we're creating this space that holds the presence of a mountain that maybe once existed, that no longer exists. So it's like working with memory and what could be lost and existential threat and life forces that perhaps once existed in this place. So it's an imagined place based on memory and of what we know of certain landscapes, but it's very timeless in a sense, but we're also working with time scales that are greater than what we can physically comprehend, like the time scale of a mountain compared to the time scale of a human, and or even just humankind, and how do we fit into that narrative, and yeah, the hierarchy of that and how we relate to that. So it's a little bit, it's sort of gone on a different, it's still, we're still looking for the personal within this big universal sort of concept, but yeah, it's more sort of about what has been lost. So it's like a future ritual to remember what was.
Yeah. Now, for part two of A Mountain, you're kind of expanding things, because for the first one you were performing solo, but this time you're actually performing with two other people, dancers Marnie and Melanie Palomares.
Yeah.
So how did that collaboration come about, and how did that kind of change the energy from solo to now a group work?
Yeah. I've known Marnie and Mel for a number of years. Just through, I guess, the industry, through the dance world, and then in recent years working together on other projects. And I really was interested in working with two other females, so it's an all-female cast. So I feel like the work is very feminine in the way that we're looking into nature and the body and how we connect with it, and perhaps that's because it's being developed by females. And yeah, it's a very different experience for me as a choreographer, because even though I was in the solo work, like I was a performer, I felt like it's very different being the only person in the space and being kind of in this, I guess, in a sense, like having some kind of control over the composition and what's happening in the moment. But there's a lot of, I'm learning a lot through being involved in this performance with two other performers who are highly experienced and amazing. Like, there's nothing for me to worry about. It's just trying to deal with this inside, internal world that we're in, like being on the inside and then also looking at it from the outside, which again comes back to this reflection of what the work is about as well, like this internal, how we relate personally to this external world that we live in. Yeah, and there's a lot more options with three bodies in the space, so it's becoming more complex in, I guess, practicing, making, and yeah, what the work is.
So, as you mentioned, more bodies in this space. The space you are working in is the Campbelltown Arts Centre. How has it been working within that area?
Yeah, Campbelltown Arts Centre is such an incredible space, and the staff here are just amazing. I feel like I've had such support, like to be an independent artist, making work is, you know, it has its challenges, and to be at Campbelltown Arts Centre as an artist in residence, it's like, I feel like I have so much room to be able to really focus on the practice and the making, and the developing of this work, and just even the developing of our collaboration. Whereas often, yeah, there's many roles that you play within making work, you know, all the administration that has to occur and organising and, yeah. So the Arts Centre has been fantastic. I must say that actually I feel like in the next week we need to do a bit of an excursion into the outdoors, because we have been working inside mostly, but yeah, and from memory of what an environment is that we're trying to create. So yes, you've just made me think about being in this area and what this area has to offer.
Sounds amazing. Thank you so much for joining us here today, Christina. We can't wait to see Mountain and where the series evolves for part three, yet to be named, I hear.
Yeah, me too.
But thanks again. You can catch Mountain at the Campbelltown Arts Centre from April 13 to 14, so a couple of weeks away.
Thanks so much.
We'll put all those details up on 2SER.com along with this podcast. Going to jump back into the music now. Here's a bit of soul from Sawn Starr. It's called Dear Mr. Teddy from the album Look Closer.
Take time out and develop your creative side at Pine Street Creative Arts Centre in Chippendale. Get hands-on to explore jewellery design, ceramics, printmaking, drawing and painting, or even bookbinding. No experience, no problem. They've got courses to suit all levels, from complete beginners to more experienced artists. Book now for 6 and 8 week courses starting in May and 1 day weekend workshops. pinestreet.com.au. City of Sydney sponsors 2SER 107.3.
You're on So Hot Right Now with me, Sophie, this long weekend for your weekly dose of arts and culture.
2SER.com.
Where are you from? No, where are you really from? It's a question constantly asked to people of colour. And you know what? It really doesn't matter because you're not entitled to their family history. In the new play Going Down, produced by Malthouse Theatre and Sydney Theatre Company, our heroine Natalie Yang is going to let where her parents come from dictate what she writes about. Joining us now is the mastermind behind the play, award-winning playwright Michelle Lee. Good morning.
G'day, Sophie. How are you going?
Good. How are you?
I'm good, thank you.
But first of all, congratulations. It's your first full length play and it's just had its world premiere.
Yeah, I'm super stoked. Yeah, so I'm based in Melbourne, but with my partner I and Bob were up in Sydney, so got to see opening night and it was fantastic.
How's the reception been so far?
Oh yeah, really good from people in the audiences. Oh, I just read a couple of reviews and I reckon like they're a little bit middle of the road. But at the same time, I enjoy reading all the reviews and seeing what people are bringing to it and how it's meeting their expectations and how it's not. But I mean, I'm really pleased with how it's come together and with the team. And it's been a couple of years in the making with intensive developments here and there. But yeah, for me, it's really it's meeting what I want the piece to be doing.
Mm. So can you tell us people asked a bit more about what the play is about?
So in terms of the plot, so it's set over a weekend and our protagonist, Natalie Yang, who's based on a version of me, she's just having a pretty shit time with the reception to her memoir, Banana Girl. And over the course of the weekend, things just progressively get worse and worse. And it's all centred around the reception to the book, which is then also centred around questions about her cultural identity. So her being based on me, she's of Hmong background, but born and raised in Australia. Mm. But, I mean, thematically, there's questions around identity, intersectionality, what audiences want from people of colour and women of colour. And also the challenges being an artist, a writer, and the play set in Melbourne, and it's a real like ode to Melbourne, but also a bit of a fun poke at Melbourne as well.
Mm, I mean, Banana Girl, the memoir that she's written, it's quite sexually explicit. How does how does that kind of like lead into it? And like with her, does that, with her culture and what people expect of her, how does she kind of navigate that?
Well, I guess being an openly sexual Asian female in some ways can be like she's the worst kind of daughter or representative of her community in some ways, because she's anti the model migrant character. And she's quite individualistic, which also is quite in opposition to the family values that we associate with Asian families and Eastern cultures. So, I mean, the fact that the book is quite sexual and that's a kind of political stance is all about kind of living in opposition and tension between her family background and contemporary Australia and contemporary Melbourne.
Mm. I love it's also called Banana Girl. I mean, it's a bit of a contentious term. In my family, it's like, oh, it's a very big insult. And sometimes when I was younger, I was like, oh, yeah, I'm a banana. But how do you feel about the term?
Oh, I'm really comfortable with it. But I think maybe it's because it's language that perhaps I'm reclaiming in a certain way. And also I'm being a bit cheeky about it. And I think it's just a bit of a shorthand to describe the sense of kind of being in between things and having internalized a sense of racism, colonialism. I mean, I think now that I'm in my 30s, when I was in my teens and in my 20s, earlier 20s I should say, I felt like deeply uncomfortable with otherness. And that desire that I think is quite common to second generation migrants, a sense of wanting to assimilate, because of course Australia is largely multicultural, but then I think it's kind of changing now, but certainly when I was growing up, multiculturalism was, it's kind of a bit superficial, maybe government policy, kind of bureaucratic, but lived experience didn't feel very multicultural. I felt very aware of my otherness, and of course there's a reaction to that, wanted to fit in. So I think that term banana kind of encapsulates that tension for me. But yeah, I get it too, because in some ways, the contention around it is that it suggests there's a hierarchy that's being bought into.
Mm.
So, I mean, and yet it's messy because it's all those things. It's about not wanting to fit into a mold about what Asian Australian people are like, but also not wanting to be erased of your culture, not wanting to be seen only as someone who's assimilated successfully.
Yeah. So the tagline is Sex and the Millennial City. What kind of millennial issues is our protagonist facing?
It's funny because she's actually, I think she's kind of aged down in the production, which it probably makes sense. I mean, she's supposed to be like just hit 30, but I think she'd be read as maybe late 20s. Her nemesis is in her early 20s and is like 100 times more successful than Natalie, 100 times more Asian. But she's a hipster. She's unashamedly a hipster, but not entirely in just in the sense of just her fashion and consumption choices, but in the sense of being very politically engaged, being quite self-assured in some ways. So because she's an artist, she's also grappled with a huge amount of self-doubt because in this day and age, being an artist is also about how you're received, and if you're not received as favorably, then you internalize that into your sense of self-worth. So she's in some ways has the hallmarks of a cliched of an inner city millennial, but then she's more than that.
Also, being an artist in a Asian family, how is that received in her family?
Well, the layers of family and the characters. I mean, the main character who is from Natalie's family is her mother, but she's peripheral. And I mean, that's kind of saying something about my own personal experience about my relationship with family. I don't live close to my family. I'm not super close to my family, and not all my family members really get or participate in my artistic practice. So I would say the fact that family are a bit absent and they don't really make an appearance in the play towards the end, I think that's kind of indicative of their relationship to Natalie. And she's probably, without saying it in the play, a little bit of not black sheep, but a bit of the odd one out. She's not with her family physically and in some ways figuratively as well.
Yeah. You mentioned her rival before, who's in her 20s, very successful. She kind of writes about culture and family. Is one of the comments in the play, she is successful because she writes what people expect her to write about?
Yeah. She conforms to the idea of using the kind of collective we want of a person of colour, particularly of Asian people, someone who fits into multicultural Australia, but in that kind of narrow sense of a multicultural Australia. She's very connected to her family. She's kind of a spokesperson in a sense for her family and then her community as well. She's Indonesian Chinese. She's kind of the opposite of Natalie, and is successful because she tells the story that we want to hear, which is the story of adversity. It's the story of you coming from a place that's less democratic, has human rights abuses, and ending up in Australia and fitting in, which I think kind of reaffirms the collective Australia, a sense of Australia being the lucky country, a place where everyone has a fair go. And I'm using these terms in inverted commas, because I think when the migrant narrative fits into, you know, the broader narrative of egalitarianism in Australia. It kind of helps us avoid, you know, other realities of, you know, our own human rights abuses. So I think that the things are intertwined. You know, the successful migrant coming from a place of tragedy into Australia and succeeding, I think it's intertwined with Australia's sense of self-image and its own kind of self-delusions and its own kind of big lies.
Mm. Well, we are definitely a delusional country. But
yeah.
So just to finish off, what do you want people to kind of take out of this play when they go see it?
Oh, I want them to have a fun time. I want them to kind of give props to the performers. I mean, the ensemble's just great. But also I want them to, you know, have a chat afterwards and, you know, talk about, you know, what's working for them and what's not, and, you know, what's funny and then what's not funny, and what are the themes that I'm exploring. And it's okay, like, if it's doesn't really hit all the marks for them, because I think most playwrights would say it's not really entirely about what happens in the room. It's also about what stays with you, what you debate, what you're reading online, and how it might settle in 2 weeks later, you know, a month later. Mm-hmm. And also, I think, you know, maybe more specifically, in those kind of, in the aftermath of the experiencing the show, I want people to, yeah, be thinking about, what is this collective Australia, and when, kind of, where are we, and can we kind of, like, move beyond the idea of you know, people of colour outside of just family narratives, or, you know, or connections with exotic tasty food. I mean, those things are, I mean that's stuff I love as well, but it's more than that. And now that, you know, particularly Southeast Asian people have been in Australia for, I don't know, it's probably going on to 3-4 generations, we just are by circumstance, we're intersectional. We are our, you know, parents' culture, that's our culture too, but we're also in, you know, Australian culture at this point in time with its own, you know, problems and realities. And it's messy. I mean, the play offers, you know, a few kind of resolutions, but that's just one version of one person's moment in time grappling with their own identity.
Well, thank you so much for chatting to us today, Michelle, and thank you for bringing more contemporary Asian Australian stories to the stage and screen. I love it. As an Asian myself, it's just nice to see yourself reflected here and there.
Yeah. Well, I hope you enjoy it.
Well, you can catch it until the beginning of May at the Sydney Theatre Company. It's called Going Down. We'll put all the juicy details on 2SER.com along with this podcast. Here's a tune now from Miss Lauryn Hill, this doo-wop that thing, who I heard killed it at Blues Fest last night.
You know you better watch out. Some guys are only about
looking for your friend, the one you let hit it and never called you again. Remember when he told you he was about to Benjamins? Yeah. You act like you ain't him, they give him a little trim to begin. Now you think you really gonna pretend like you wasn't down and you called him again. Plus when you give it up so easy, you ain't even fooling him. If you did it then you probably can. Talking out your neck saying you're a Christian, a Muslim, sleeping with the gin. Now that was the sin that did Jezebel in. Who you gonna tell when the repercussions spin? Showing off your ass cause you're thinking it's a trend. Girlfriend, let me break it down for you again. You know I only say it cause I'm truly genuine. Don't be a hard rock when you really are a gem, baby girl. Respect is just a minimum. But you still defending them now. Lauryn is only human. Don't think I haven't been through the same predicament. Let it sit inside your head like a million women in Philly pen. It's silly when girls sell their souls because it's sin. Look at where you be in. Hair weaves like Europeans. Fake nails done by Koreans. Come again.
Watch out, some girls are only
related to the man. More concerned with his rims and his Timbs and his women. Him and his man. Come in the club, I come to dance. Don't care who they defend, popping yang.
Like you got yang.
Let's not pretend. The one to pack pissed out by the waistband. Chris out by the casement. Still the name of this basement. The pretty face man. Claiming that they did a bid, man. Need to take care of their 3 and 4 kids. Been the face in court case when the child support late. Money taking, heart breaking. Now you wonder why women hate me. And the sleepy silent man. The punk domestic violence man. The quick to stop asking them. Stop acting like boys and be men. How you gon' win when you ain't right within? How you gon' win when you ain't right within? How you gon' win when you ain't right within? Come again. Yo, come again.
Hi, I'm Craig Donarski, director of Casula Powerhouse Art Centre in Liverpool, and we've got hundreds of things for you to see and do and be part of this year. Right now in the galleries, you can catch the Archibald Prize on its regional tour. If you missed it in the city, here's your chance to see it. In the theatre, we have the Alliance Française French Film Festival from Thursday the 5th of April to Sunday the 8th of April. 6 of the best French films, tickets from $13. On Tuesday the 17th of April at 7:30 p.m., the Garifuna Collective featuring Umalali. We're open 7 days a week, except for public holidays, and you can always add on breakfast, brunch or lunch at Bellbird Dining and Bar, featuring fresh produce harvested from our kitchen garden. And see everything that's on offer at casulapowerhouse.com.
You're listening to So Hot Right Now with me, Sophie. Oh my gosh, how great is that tone from Lauryn Hill? Oldie but a goodie, and so jealous of anyone who was up at Blues Fest to see her perform it live last night. Oh my gosh. We are listening to So Hot Right Now, your weekly dose of arts and culture.
Stories, ideas, music. 2SER 107.3.
Ah, the days of working in a movie theatre, cleaning up people's leftover popcorn and drinks, mopping up the floors and running the film projector. You know, the glamorous side of working in film. This is the premise of Annie Baker's award-winning play, The Flick, which will be having its Sydney premiere this week at the Seymour Centre and presented by Outhouse Theatre. We're joined now by director Craig Baldwin. Good morning, Craig.
Good morning, Sophie. How are you?
I'm very well. How are you?
Good, good. In the middle of busy rehearsals, but good.
Yeah. Now, for people who are unfamiliar with the work, what is The Flick?
The Flick is a Pulitzer Prize-winning play about a group of people who work in a sort of rundown, failing movie theater in the backwoods of Massachusetts in America. And it sort of gives their, I might say, little lives a sort of epic treatment. So while they're sweeping popcorn, betrayals happen, corruption creeps into this movie theater, love triangles occur, all while sweeping popcorn and mopping up soda.
That's a lot to happen in a small town movie theater.
Exactly, exactly. And that sort of juxtaposition creates a lot of sort of amazing comedy in it. And also this sort of beautiful thing where you sort of realize that the people who tear your tickets actually have this whole amazing life that you might not think about because they're just there tearing your ticket.
Like working in a movie theater, there's also that kind of element of, it's quite a mundane job of just, you know, sweeping and tearing tickets, serving you popcorn. How do you kind of like break that up, since this is quite a long play, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. It's so Annie Baker, the writer, is sort of known for her hypernaturalism, you might say. So the famous thing is the Annie Baker pause. So there's sections of the play that are really in silence and are just sort of people sweeping and mopping. But the repetition of that is where, like, all those, you know, juicy betrayals and love affairs that I was talking about start to sort of slowly come out over the course of the evening. And they sort of slowly seep into your consciousness as you're watching it. So the duration of it is really part of the effect. And by the end of it, you sort of realize you are completely invested in all their trials and tribulations, even though at first you've just been watching them sweep popcorn.
Now, sweeping popcorn, that sounds like it's going to be quite a set for them to actually sweep the popcorn somewhere. How is it looking?
It's getting there. It's getting there. It's a lot of work. We are trying to really install a whole movie theater in the theater at the Seymour Center. So I think it's going to be one of the most exciting aspects of it. And our designer, Hugh O'Connor, has sort of imagined that this theater's heyday might have been in the 80s.
Right.
So you can imagine the kind of movie theater carpet that we've been searching for.
You got movie theater carpet.
Oh, yeah, from the 80s.
What?
Yes.
That's ridiculous.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, my gosh.
I was a little too excited about the carpet when we found it.
You know it's good when the director is excited about the carpet. You know, you've talked about, like, you know, there are love trials in this, but it's actually quite a small cast. So is it like their relationships between each other or people with the outside world?
Yeah, there's a couple of sort of offstage figures that are mentioned that exert kind of a force on these characters. There's also a big transition happening in the movie theater in that the play was written in 2013 and set in 2013, where most of these small movie theaters had to switch from a film projector, a 35mm film projector, to like a digital Blu-ray kind of projector.
Mm.
And so that's also happening at this time. And there's this sort of beautiful sort of sense of loss of something. I always compare it to the difference between playing like a song on vinyl and getting that sort of nice, warm, crackly, sort of slightly flawed but beautiful sound, as opposed to playing, you know, a CD or an MP3, which is so sort of cold but very clear and crisp, you know. It's sort of the same difference between a movie played on film and a movie shot digitally. And the play explores that loss, and you sort of start to see how that resonates with these characters' lives in their sort of attempt for something warmer, some kind of human connection, some kind of analog lifestyle that's not about digital disconnection, I guess.
So very nostalgic in that way.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of nostalgia in it. And I think it sort of goes beyond that to sort of ask, like, is there something we've lost in our interpersonal relationships? You know, the digital age is sort of about, we're looking for flawless interaction, we're looking for sort of cold, clean interaction. And it's sort of nice to see these misfits sort of stumbling and failing and trying to connect with each other. It sort of reminds you that, you know, being human is a bit messy, and that's and that may be something we've lost in the digital age.
Now, who's playing these messy characters?
So we have Jeremy Waters, who's playing Sam, the 35-year-old guy who's still working in the movie theater and living in his parents' attic.
Amazing.
Yes. And we have Mia Lethbridge, who she's playing the projectionist, who's a 26-year-old girl who dyes her hair green and drinks moonshine. And then we have the newcomer to the movie theater, the 20-year-old Avery, who's an African-American kid, played by Justin Amank... Oh, God, I'm going to say this wrong, and he's going to kill me. Amankawa. And Justin is actually 20 himself and just coming out of drama school. He's a,
oh, wow.
He's a kind of really exciting find. So I think it's exciting to have his debut be in this play. And then there's a fourth character played by Matthew Cheatham, but I'm not going to tell you anything about that character because that's got to be a surprise.
Ooh, surprises. We like it. Now, this is the Sydney premiere. How are you feeling? A lot of pressure?
I'm excited by it because it really is. It was surprising to me that it hadn't been performed in Sydney yet. It's really sort of taken the world by storm, this play and Annie Baker's writing in general. Obviously, winning the Pulitzer was a big thing, but it had huge productions in New York. And I say productions because it was so successful, it went on to have a commercial run for a year after its premiere. And it had a major production at the National Theatre in London, and it's been performed sort of all over the world at this point. So, well, now that you mention it, that is actually a lot of pressure. So I hope we'll do it justice. But at least I can say the play has been tried and tested and come out well. So.
So there's also a lot of references in the play to, like, cinema, film. Is it a play for film lovers, or is it a film, or is it a play for people who just love the theatre?
You know, both, I will say. But I would say movie lovers will. There's a character in the play who is a movie lover himself. So there is a lot in it about movies, and that nostalgia I mentioned for a time when going to the movie theater was sort of an event, and hearing the crackle of the projector coming from the projector booth had sort of a thrill, had a little excitement to it, and definitely sort of a yearning for something we've lost in movie theaters. You know, it's just not the same to sit at home and, you know, watch something on your TV with no one around and all the distractions of home life. Going to the theater is an event. So yeah, I think movie lovers would really be interested in this. And of course, there's all kinds of references to movies throughout it. So.
Well, there's an added bonus if you're a movie lover, isn't there?
Yeah, absolutely. We are lucky enough that Palace Cinemas has joined us to say that they will give a free 1-year membership to every ticket buyer to the Flick.
There you go. If that's not a selling point, I don't know what is.
Absolutely.
Well, the Flick starts from this Thursday at the Seymour Centre. It'll be running till April 21st. But Craig, thank you so much for joining us here on 2SER.
Thanks so much, Sophie.
So we'll put all those details of where you can get tickets to the Flick, as I just mentioned, opened up from Thursday at the Seymour Centre, along with this podcast, on 2SER.com. We've got about 6 and a bit minutes to go. So here's a tune now from the wonderful Alabama Shakes with Future People. You're here on 2SER.
Hi, my name's Craig Donarski. I'm the director at Casula Powerhouse Arts Centre in Liverpool. Actually, we're one stop past Liverpool, but don't hold that against us. We've got a couple of great gigs on sale at the moment, both in April, but you'll have to move quickly to get tickets for these. Youth Group's Toby Martin is doing Songs from Northam Avenue on Saturday the 14th of April at 7 p.m. Tickets are $25 or $20 concession, and he has the most amazing band for this, including Brie Van Rijk, Zoe Hauptmann, Muhammad Lilo, and Dang Lan. Also on sale and just a few days after, on Tuesday the 17th of April at 7:30, we have the Garifuna Collective featuring Umalali. This is music that brings East Africa to the Caribbean and mashes it up with so many sounds from the area. You've never heard anything like this before. They're in town for the Commonwealth Games Festival in Brisbane, and we're lucky enough to pick them up for one night only before they get there. We have excellent free parking, one stop past Liverpool on the railway line, and for more information, visit casulapowerhouse.com.
Well, I was riding down the highway just a trying 99. Had a place I needed to be, and I had to be on time. Cars, they started slowing down the line. People just gave all, and all gone for miles. Stared out the window just as far as I could see. I saw no light and nothing, and I sat back comfortably. About the time she rolled that window down, the time it all went wrong. I swear to you, Lord, I'm about to pull this damn wheel off. Talking more, talking blue. Now, if you're running down that highway and you're thinking 99, if you're late, be late, unless your chances take your time. All you got to do, bud, is lay off that home, make a stop. Talking more, talking blue.